Hi everyone and welcome to MemCast. My name is Dr. Rachel Saville and I'll be your host today. This is the last of our MemCast medical education series with Dr. Cooper, and we're going to be talking about diagnosis and the reflective mind. We're going to be discussing metacognition, so the ability to think about your own thinking, which is like reflecting during the decision-making process, and explore some other factors which might influence our decision-making. So thanks for coming back to talk to us again, Dr. Cooper.
Thank you very much indeed, Dr. Saville and Rachel. Yeah, this is a struggle to get into, 10 to 15 minutes, to be honest. But I'll do my best. And then if people want to know more, you can have a look at the ABC of clinical reasoning or some other stuff. But we know from education that a metacognitive approach to instruction is really important. It increases attainment. That's getting people to think about their own thinking and their own learning while they solve problems, yeah? And so we can do this as teachers or as more senior doctors with our junior doctors as well and our medical students. It's a really key skill. So I guess there's a few things just to recap. The first thing to recap is, do you remember we talked about system one and system two? We have this fast, intuitive, automatic way of thinking and decision making. Then we have a more deliberate, slower, sometimes slower, effortful way of thinking and decision making called system two. And system two is language based and uses rules and strategies and things. And its distinct attribute is its ability to engage in cognitive simulation, often in the form of an internal dialogue. Yeah. Lots of experiments in psychology and functional MRI support this, that we have these two main ways of thinking and decision making. And for anyone who wants to know, that's called dual process theories. Now, the reason why I'm recapping that is because there's agreement among many psychologists and others that actually there's a third process that's really important in making good decisions. And sometimes it's called metacognition, depending which background you come from. So that's a word often used in education. And there's a cognitive psychologist called Stanovich who calls it the reflective mind. But for us, we can just call it reflection or metacognition or whatever. The reflective mind is really a subset of system two, yeah, because it's effortful, it's conscious, it's serial in nature, and it's language-based as well, often in the form of an internal conversation. So that's what we're going to talk about today, and I'm going to show you some evidence about the difference this makes. Let's just talk about reflection for a moment, because it's a really abused, misunderstood term in medical education, I feel. There's different types of reflection. And so what we're talking about here is during decision making, just to make that clear. A really good definition of reflection is from John Sanders, who's a retired GP and professor of MedEd. He says reflection is a metacognitive process that occurs before, during, and after situations with the purpose of developing greater understanding of both the self and the situation, so that future encounters are informed from previous encounters, yeah? That's really based, I guess, on Dewey, a famous educator, who said, you don't learn from experience. You learn from experience and then reflecting on the experience. But I love the idea that reflection is something that happens before, during, and after. And when I'm explaining this, I often ask the med regs in the room, put your hand up if you visualize on the way to an emergency. Put your hand up if when you're lying in bed at night, you sometimes visualize in your head what good looks like, when, say, running a complex arrest or something. And about half of them will put their hands up because high performers have a mental representation of what good looks like, and they often visualize it in advance. So reflection is something that can happen before. Anyway, several studies have shown that if you reflect during decision making, it improves your diagnostic performance and quite significantly. And we also know that if we get students to reflect while we're teaching them using cases, not only does it make them more accurate, but it helps them to learn. And so when they are solving more difficult cases a week later, they're better again. And reflection during decision making can be dead simple. It can be literally, what's the evidence for this? What else could it be? Now, I use that on the assessment unit, for example. I remember a registrar coming to me and saying, this patient has encephalitis. And I used a technique called self-explanation, which is very powerful, more powerful than the instructor explaining. And I said, okay, so instead of saying why? That's not a helpful question, because automatically you think, oh no, I've got it wrong. And then you think, oh, what's in her head? But I said, can you list the findings in the history and the exam and the initial test results that are pointing to this diagnosis of encephalitis. And so just by getting someone to think, what's the evidence for this? What else could it be? It really helps you with your diagnostic accuracy. We know that from studies. And so getting people to just stop and reflect in the moment while they're solving a case improves diagnostic performance. So why does reflection work? It's the only cognitive intervention that's consistently been shown to be effective in improving our clinical reasoning. The problem is that, you know, the teacher isn't always there, right? The teacher isn't always there to say, what's the evidence for this? What else could it be? So this is where individual differences come in. Now, what's really interesting is that there are a few individual differences in our tendency to engage in type one thinking. Yeah, so we all have this tendency to take shortcuts and be efficient from a cognitive point of view. There are definitely individual differences when it comes to engaging in type two thinking. So, for example, there are differences in intelligence or what we might call cognitive ability, but they don't explain all of the variation in individual performance. In psychology, what's been found is that differences in people's cognitive style explains the greatest proportion of variation in performance on reasoning tasks.
So what do you mean about cognitive style?
Yeah, so this guy Stanovich calls it thinking dispositions, is another term for it. But cognitive style is how we differ in our tendency to seek information, look for evidence, analyse, weigh things up, to be healthily sceptical about what other people say or other people's diagnosis, to be aware of context and to think about our own thinking. There are actually validated scores in psychology, validated questionnaires, active open-minded thinking, need for cognition, scores like that. You can measure it. This idea that our cognitive style actually makes a difference in performance on reasoning tasks is a really interesting one to me, because we all know people who are just really good, yeah? Really good thinkers and decision makers in medicine, even though they may not yet have passed their MRCP. And then we all know people who've passed their MRCP and have been, let's say, a med reg for ages, and they're not as good as that person who may be more junior to them. Yeah. Have you noticed? I mean, you know, there's definitely individual variation in performance, isn't there?
Yeah. And would you say the cognitive style was a skill that could be learned or adopted?
That is such a good question. Actually, I believe from my reading in the literature that it is both a trait and a state, but also it can be taught, yeah? Because first of all, it's a trait. In other words, we will vary, all of us will vary. There are some people who are just naturally good at it. They have healthy thinking dispositions, right? So they're always going to be better decision makers. So we all vary. There are some people who are naturally good, but definitely there are people where we can help them develop these thinking habits through the way we teach when practicing with cases. It's also a state, yeah? It depends on our motivation, our mood, whether it's in the middle of the night, all these things. We know, for example, sleep deprivation really impairs ability to use system two and to use cognitive effort, basically. Mm-hmm. So it's a state as well.
Yeah, that's why it's so difficult to do our SLEs or ACATs after the end of a night shift.
Yeah, exactly. But also from education, we know that we can teach people, you know, like I said, there's really good evidence that this metacognitive approach to instruction increases attainment by several months, but that's work yet to be done in medical education. But in a nutshell, optimal decision making, good decision making definitely requires knowledge, but also there's something about our tendency to reflect during decision making. Now, you don't need to do it all of the time. This is, I will just finish with this, because actually the fact of the matter is, sometimes a low effort, good enough response is all that's needed. Yeah. Imagine if you're triaging a bunch of patients in ED or something, you know what I mean? Or you're the med reg and you've got so many patients to see. You can't be, you know, dead deliberate and over thorough with everyone. You couldn't function as a med reg, basically. But sometimes a low effort, good enough response is required. But sometimes we have to slow down when we should. And we know from the literature that experts use multiple strategies depending on the circumstances. So no one type of thinking or processing is inherently better than the other. They have different functions, They have different strengths and weaknesses, system one, system two, and we divide system two into the algorithmic mind and the reflective mind. Yeah. But the challenge for us as in MedEd, I guess, is to provide multiple tasks so we can teach multiple strategies. We need to equip learners to be able to think and reason through lots of different clinical problems effectively, don't we?
Mm. And then to understand when is the best time to use each of these thinking.
Yeah, and I'll just finish with one last point, which is that sometimes we talk about expertise as being a destination. There's another point of view, which is that expertise is a process. And what distinguishes expert learners from less expert learners is that once they're able to do something automatically and their cognitive resources are now freed up, yeah, you know, which is what basically happens when you become a med reg, is that they reinvest those mental resources and they start to look at things in a different way. They continue to learn. They continue to invest in learning. They follow up patients. They study. They cultivate these habits of mind. They work in clinically rich environments. So they're getting lots of experience, but also reflecting on that experience. And there's research that shows that what makes some people become excellent, as opposed to experienced non-experts, is that expert learner behaviour.
Mm-hmm. So definitely something to bear in mind as we continue through our training.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Dr. Cooper. That's really helpful. And thank you for this whole series. It's been really informative.
My pleasure. It's been very interesting to talk to you. Thanks.
Thank you. And we'll see you again next week for our next episode of MemCast.